Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Welcome, David Hepworth, to this edition of the Stack Waddy Game. Now, this is inspired by my discovery that the Kaiser Chiefs is both the name of a rock band and a football team, which I didn't know.
Did you know that? Football team, yeah.
Oh, you did know that? Okay, well, I didn't know that. So the band who formed in Leeds in 2000 presumably took their name from the football club based in Zimbabwe since 1960.
Oh, Zimbabwe, so is it? Not South Africa.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so it struck me that that it sounded perfectly natural as either, and that there were a lot of football clubs that could be rock bands, particularly indie gangs, and there were a lot of bands that could be football clubs. So I'm asking you, soft-centred indie flag wavers or hoofers of the bladder? All right? Let me try.
Hoofers
of the bladder. Okay. Okay. The Arcadia Shepherds.
Hoofers of the bladder into the onion bag.
That's right. Yeah.
Go on. What was the first one?
The Arcadia Shepherds.
The Arcadia Shepherds. Are they a football
rock
team
band or football
or
team?
An indie group? Oh, good grief. They're an indie group.
They are, in fact, a South African football team based in Pretoria. Okay, the Go Ahead Eagles. They're good, aren't they?
That sounds very good.
The Go Ahead Eagles.
Football team.
They are. They're Dutch, and they're from Deventer, and they play in the Eerste Divisie. Okay, the New England Roses. New England Roses.
It's got to be a football team.
It sounds like it, doesn't it? But in fact, they are an East Coast lo-fi pop and electronica band formed in 2002.
Oh,
who famously covered George Michael and Tracy Chapman, it says here. The Black Leopards. Black Leopards.
Black Leopards.
You'd
Black
be a member Leopard. Of the Black
Leopards. Oh, God. Oh, I'm going to go the other way. Indie group.
No, they're a football team from Limpopo, playing the Premier Soccer League. Yeah, yeah. The Peach Kings. It's perfectly put. You can imagine. I'm going to see the Peach Kings on Saturday.
Who support the Peach Kings? Indie group.
Indie, they are. American rock band. Right. They won the Unsigned Artist of the Year in a competition by Paste magazine. Okay, the Fiery Furnaces. Cover a couple more. Fiery Furnaces.
Group. Band.
Group, absolutely right. Formed in 2000 in Brooklyn, New York. Brother and sister in the band whose surname is Friedberger. That's a splendid name, isn't it?
Very good.
Okay, idealistic rock band or lower league football champions, the Golden Arrows.
Football team.
Yep, based in Durban. Orlando Pirates.
Oh, football team, I know that.
Yeah, they are actually from Johannesburg. Yeah, the Starlight Mints.
They're from Orlando, surely, the Orlando Pirates, aren't they? Orlando, Florida.
I got it down there from Johannesburg. I don't know. Okay. The Starlight Mints.
Starlight Mints. Pop group. Indie
group. Pop group, which is because there is no place called Starlight, I don't think. No, absolutely. Pitchfork called their The Dream That Stuff Was Made Of album a short, well-sequenced offering of punchy orchestral pop.
Oh,
and lastly...
That is a damning by faint praise review. If
it really is, isn't it? Yeah.
A short, well-paced offering. Oh, imagine taking a record home from the shop. Are you excited? Yes, it's a well-paced offering.
It's well-paced. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like liking people because they're punctual. Okay, last one, very easy. The Alabama Shakes.
They're a pop group.
They are a pop group. It's good though, isn't it? The Jasmine Minks, Mexican Pets, it works, I think. Go on, so what have you got? What have you got?
Well, because I've been laid up. I've been indisposed the last few days.
You've been peely-wally, as my mum used to say.
Peely-wally. I've been eating something eggy off a tray and rising at lunch to take a little light junket and then returning to my couch. Couch with an Agatha Christie novel. I haven't been able to...
A damp paw pressed to your forehead and a jigsaw.
Yes, imagine Chatterton, the poet, on his...
Yes, on his the death of Chatterton.
But I'm back. I'm back, but not back it's in time to devise a wholly original... A Stack Waddy Game. So I've taken the liberty, and I hope you will forgive me, of our erstwhile colleague, Nige Tassel, friend of the pod, some while ago sent me a couple of these things where we started doing Stat Woody game. He sent me a thing which should actually run, I think, in Word, which was dubstep actor Doctor Who villain. He made. Do you remember this?
I think
I vaguely do remember. He says, and also he said he'd done a thing which was a half man, half biscuit songs. Are they real or are they fake? Which he said he waved in front of you years ago or something, and you hadn't got it or whatever. And anyway, he kept the bit of paper.
Well, it's a good idea that's impossible, because this is the people who did All I Want for Christmas is a Dukla Praga Away Kit.
Anything is
possible.
To make up a pinching Nigel's work here, I should just plug, this is Nigel's new book which he sent me. And It's a Beautiful Day, a Fargo companion. So for anybody who's a lover of Fargo, the movie or the TV series, that's something to look out for.
It really is. You sent one to me, absolutely, too. I love that film. Endless mystery. Didn't somebody die going to the location where it was shot and trying to dig for the buried gold?
The briefcase.
Do you remember? It was a while ago. Yeah, they kind of thought, they were so confused by fact and fiction that they were actually digging for what they thought was the hidden case and died in the cold. So, yes, what an extraordinary.
Okay, here you go. Here you go. Half man, half biscuit songs. Real or fake? Helvellyn is a place on earth. Helvellyn is a place on earth.
Christ, that's brilliant. I'm going to say that's real. I ought to know these. It's been a long time since I've listened to them, actually. I'm going to say that's real, actually, because I think I've got a feeling he's a bit of a...
No, it's not. It's fake. Okay.
Very good.
he who would Valium take.
Very good. Oh, my Lord. I want them all to be real. That's so good. What is it? Is it real?
It is real. It's real.
To be a pilgrim.
Something's rotten in the back of Iceland. Something's rotten in the back of Iceland.
Fantastic. God, you know, I've got absolutely no idea. Again, I want it to be real. Let's say it is.
It is real. It is real.
Very good.
Okay.
Very, very good.
Excavating Rita. Excavating Rita.
Superb. Not real, but it's
It genius. Is real. It is real.
It is. Excavating Rita.
Malmesbury Marmite Sandwich War. Malmesbury Marmite Sandwich War. Is it fake or is it real?
God, that's student life condensed into just one short phrase. Yeah, isn't it? I would say absolutely. God, do you remember they played at the Cornbury Festival? We got them on our stage. And I can remember Nigel turned up with a fantastic guitar, the shape of a bus. I think that's real, Dave. I'm sorry, I think that's real.
That's fake.
Okay.
Okay. Next one. The Nightingales played in Berkeley Square.
Fantastic. That's genius. That's absolutely.
Is that a real half man half biscuit?
I don't think it is, but he's the sort of person who would write a song about the Nightingales, because they're sort of vaguely in the same bracket, aren't they?
No, it's fake. It's fake.
Okay, good.
Tommy Walsh's Eco House.
God, no, I really don't. No idea.
That is real. That is real. My personal favorite here. I had possession over Pancake Day.
Fantastic. That's brilliant. It is real.
Number three, his
job is done, isn't it? When he sits there and he writes a title like that, really, I mean, the song itself doesn't really matter, does it? The important thing is that people like you and I are just talking about what the song's called.
Okay.
Fantastic.
Three more quickly. I don't want to play for Chelsea.
Fantastic. This is so funny. God, I don't know. I mean, yeah, let's say it's true. Everybody hates Chelsea. Yes.
It's fake. It's fake.
Oh, okay.
Took Problem Chimp to Ideal Home Show. Is that real or is that fake? Took Problem Chimp to Ideal Home Show.
It's fabulous. I'm going for real.
It is real. It is real.
Yeah, yeah.
And finally, Eamon Holmes under the hammer. Eamon Holmes under the hammer.
Well, that's got to be real because they're obsessed with daytime TV. So it's, I would say so.
No, it's God, fake. It's made up by Nigel Dazzle.
There's really
Nigel's
good.
Book, and it's a beautiful day, a Fargo companion.
Completely ran circles around me.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
We're back. We're delighted to have a guest, actually, because this weekend, this very day we're recording this, the March the 21st, 2021, is 50 years to the day since Led Zeppelin played the Nottingham Boat Club, which proved to be their most famous gig ever. And our old mate and friend of the pod was actually there, Trevor Dann. Hello, Trevor.
Hello, Dave.
It's a very exciting anniversary for you this weekend, presumably. Do you get together with other people who were at the gig?
That's right. We all sit on the floor and and look up Robert Plant's flared trouser leg. I mean, I would never have remembered it if you hadn't tweeted about it, but it is a memorable occasion.
So tell us about you. I mean, you're obviously from Nottingham. How did you end up there? Go on. What were you at sixth form at the time? What was
I was in that curious hiatus that you have when you go to Oxford or Cambridge in those days. So I just come out of school and I was working. And Led Zeppelin were doing their tour of thank yous to small venues. And it was free, but you had to join the Nottingham Boat Club. These boat clubs, by the way, are like the boat houses that you see every year on the telly for the boat race along the Thames.
Yeah.
And they sit along the Trent right next to Nottingham Forest Football Club. And there are three of them, the Union, the Boat and the Brit. And the other two used to do discos or dances, but the Boat was the one that had this sort of John Peel kind of Radio Geronimo vibe.
And so how big was it then? I mean, what was the capacity?
It held, I would estimate, about 200, perhaps a little more.
Wow. 200?
Really tiny. I mean, this was the upstairs room above where they kept the actual skulls in the boats, and so you would walk.
And they did it to raise money, didn't they? Because they wanted some more money to buy some more boats, I think. And then discovered that the amount of damage inflicted on the property by the people who came, in fact, eradicated all their profits. It's been sad, really.
And then the other thing was that because everybody was sitting down, if you wanted to go for a beer, you'd got to walk through the crowd. And then come back spilling the beer.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
So everybody got covered in the stuff. And that wasn't very good for the story always was that the beer used to leak through into the boats below. Oh, so whether that's true, I don't know.
So it must have been a very small gig, even by the standards of that tour, which was mainly student unions and medium-sized gigs, wasn't it?
Yes, I think it was small, and clearly they had loved it. They'd played there before, I think, in 1969. I didn't go to that, but I think the story always was that one or all of them wanted to play the Boat Club again because it was such a great place. And let's remember that in 1971 a band like Led Zeppelin was very, very loud, and they liked playing the Boat Club by the river because there were no houses around. That's so there was funny. Nobody to complain.
So what kind of show was it? Was there a support act or anything like that?
No, there was no support act. I remember two things about it. One is that Led Zeppelin 3 had come out and was familiar to everybody. So I think we all thought, well, they're bound to start with Immigrant Song. And they actually came out and played Communication Breakdown.
All right.
And we thought, oh, hello, this is odd. Yeah. So I remember them not playing as much from Led Zeppelin 3 as I had wanted them to.
Right.
But then the other thing I remember, which, I mean, this just sounds like you're making it up, but it is true that Robert Plant said from the middle of the stage, we're going to play a song we've never played before now. We've just recorded this. Hope you like it. And they started this rather dirgy, folky thing, which suddenly kicked off in the middle. And that was Stairway to Heaven.
Didn't come out for another 6 months, did
absolutely
it?
Absolutely not. No.
Yeah. Didn't they play, first of all, in Belfast on the same tour, I think? I don't know. But they may have played it earlier.
And that they But that was a remarkable thing, because that's what made you think, ah, this group is changing now. This is this group is going a wincy bit, you know, folky and not quite so much, you know, based around John Bonham.
Yeah, I tell you what, I was thinking about this last night, and the business about seated audiences, which were clearly. I mean, it's so interesting that so many of the most legendary live albums, Who Live Elites being a case, Rolling Stones Get Your Yah-Yahs Out, from that era, were recorded in front of audiences who were not just sitting, but sitting on the floor. Because if you're
sitting on bare boards a lot of the time, with no heating and no bar.
No, but more to the point, Mark, you know, you can't. Truly excited audience who are sitting on the floor, because they're not going to rise to their feet if they're sitting on the floor. If you're sitting on a seat, you can animate them to get up. That's not hard.
Yeah.
But if they're down there, they're not going to do that, are they, at all? Now, what was the reason, for the benefit of younger listeners, what was the reason why audiences sat on the floor in those days?
Well, I think it was... partly that we all thought we were still at primary school, and we were doing morning assembly.
It's a parquet floor. We sat on it.
Yeah, that's it.
Take all your names before they begin. Dan T. That's right. Yes, Hepworth.
I think it was to do with it was a kind of hippie statement about we don't do dancing.
Yeah.
You know, that's so uncool, cavorting around. We don't do that. We've grown out of that. You know, so we're gonna sit down, and okay, we've come to this venue where there's no seats. Hell, we can manage it on the floor. Yeah. And so we did that. And I really remember, I think it was the year after this, Captain Beefheart play Nottingham University, and they started on with "I'm gonna booglarize you, baby," and we're all sitting down there, you know. Paying obeisance to the mighty captain, and he walks on and he goes, "Get up!" So we all stood up. It was the first time I'd ever stood up at a gig, and my girlfriend at the time therefore couldn't see. So we didn't think that was progress.
It's very funny what you say that thing about dancing. Because I was reading something recently, some reminiscences of a musician in the late 60s. And said you used to go and do gigs before the gig circuit was really properly established. And there would be two sorts of audience in there. There would be largely girls who would want to dance. They'd want to act as if it was like Top of the Pops. And then there were a bunch of people who were largely boys who wanted to sit down and appreciate the solos. So I suppose... you know, that's
precisely it. It was the people sitting down appreciating the solos that allowed rock groups to expand in that fashion, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And to kind of, you know, and to produce 25-minute epics, because everyone was sitting there concentrating. They had their attention.
I think it also meant that bands could play at a place like the Boat Club and be thoroughly boring for an hour and a half, and they could rest assured that
captive
no
audience.
Yeah, no one was going to leave because they couldn't get up.
That's
and get out.
That's true. No, you wouldn't drift out once you're sitting down cross-legged.
It's a bit of a statement, isn't it? Excuse me, stepping across everybody. I've got to go. This is such shit.
So upon such tropes, the careers of Barclay James Harvest and others were based.
So how long did they play? Can you remember?
I can't, but it. I think it was quite long.
It would be, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, those kind of gigs tended to be about an hour. So if you went to see, you know, Blodwyn Pig, you got about an hour, I think.
Right.
But my recollection of Led Zeppelin was that it went on and on. But in a good way.
But this is what they said at the time, that they didn't want support acts, because unless they played for 2.5 hours, you weren't getting Led Zeppelin. By which they meant you weren't getting the bass solo, you weren't getting the drum solo, you weren't getting the, you know, the kind of mad pyrotechnics with the guitar, which all had to be built in, and then you had to do your big songs. So it was 2.5 hours or whatever it was, which was a hell of a long time in those days.
And the drum solo was particularly grueling because obviously it combined with the largest queue at the bar.
Yeah.
So you couldn't even refresh yourself.
Oh. And a lot of it, if I remember right, it was done with his actual fists. Do you remember that?
I do.
He used to actually get rid of the sticks and just be thumping the tubs, you know.
Yeah.
Incredible.
And there was a sense of, could you please stop and play us some music now?
Yeah.
The best bit of any drum solo is the end of the drum solo when the music comes back
That's
in.
That's it. Yeah.
That's just
relief,
the best bit.
Relief.
Oh,
and
we're so thrilled.
Why did they do it again? Because they toured America playing those huge coliseums, hadn't they, and the civic centres and big, they weren't stadiums, but they were big arenas at the time. Was it a kind of thanks very much to
that
UK,
was it?
We haven't forgotten you?
Yeah, it was the thank you tour. And that's why people... in Nottingham, we're all, you know, terribly proud of this. This was a great moment. But mighty Led Zeppelin are coming to play our town.
Now, so while we got you here, and while we're in the year 71, there's another artist we want to talk about whose reputation now is so huge, it's difficult for anybody to imagine their years in obscurity. Because both you and Magic Alex up there have got some connection with Nick Drake, whose album Brighter Later came out pretty much this week, 50 years ago. Also, Trevor, you wrote a book about Nick Drake, but it's still available. Still available, Nick. I'm sure
still selling.
Still selling. nobody else has written a book about Nick Drake. Am I right?
Patrick Humphreys wrote a book about him before mine.
Okay.
Mine's 15 years old and there hasn't...
Is it really? Wow. Yeah. Well, that's the beauty of that story. It doesn't change very much. The other connection with Nick Drake is that Alex, you went to school, is that right, in Tanworth in Arden, which is where...
I did. And the school was affixed to Mary Magdalene Church, which is where he's buried. I was blissfully unaware at the time, of course. There's a very high probability, I'd say probably 70 to 87%, that I kicked a football at his headstone inadvertently at some point.
So what year were you born, Alex?
83. It pains me to say that these days.
It does say. 83. Where was Nick Drake's reputation in 1983, Trevor? Because nowadays he's the cult figure to end all cult figures, but that doesn't happen overnight, does it?
No, he was in the early to mid 80s. He was just beginning to be discovered in America because of the use of his music in some adverts,
right?
And that's what kicked off interest in him again.
Because didn't Lucindy Williams did Which Will or something like that on that?
I think so. And an
American actor did a documentary about him too, didn't he?
Oh, that was years later, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was years later. Brad Pitt voiced that. I think what was going on was that Nick Drake was one of those names like Jeff Buckley that just got dropped in every interview you ever read with anyone. You know, because you were doing Q, you know, you could interview folk people and rock people and jazz people. And there was always I've always loved Nick Drake.
Yeah.
And it was, he just became the name to drop. And I think that pretty much happened in the middle 80s.
Right, right. But none of your music mad mates, you know, growing up and going to school in Tanworth and Arden and going to the Cubs and so forth. Would have known who he was, Alex. Is that
no?
True?
Certainly to my knowledge, none of my lot had any idea that he even existed. We went to Cubs on Bates Lane, where his family still to this day, as far as I'm aware, have property.
The
Drake family still lives up there.
Farleys,
yep. God, that brings back memories. We had absolutely no idea, and in fact, I first became aware of Nick Drake when I read about him in some issue of Q magazine. And it wasn't until I'd seen him mentioned a couple of times that the Tanworth and Arden connection was made clear. And I went, oh. And then I found out there's a pilgrimage every year. So there's a gathering, people go to the church, people sit on the green.
Well, I think his gravestone's been removed, actually. I've got a feeling, because people went there, pilgrims, and then chipped a piece off it and took it with them. I know, I think so, yeah.
Very untanworth.
People are appalling about things.
I know, it's very grim, yeah.
Well, Dan, was that tombstone in, is it Atlanta, Georgia, or Macon, or whatever, where Elizabeth Reed, you know, the Allman Brothers tune?
Allman Brothers, yes, yeah.
And isn't there an actual gravestone which initially inspired it, which people used to just hang around smoking dope and drinking cheap wine and writing their names on? Is that appalling behavior?
It's terrible. I know, absolutely terrible.
Yes. So have we decided, is it still there, the gravestone? We don't know. Alex, you're gonna have to go and find it.
Okay. Yeah, I will. I've never actually been hunting for it, which is kind of sacrilege, really.
If you're looking for ore, it says, "Now we rise and we are everywhere."
Ooh,
that's
cool.
On it.
Oh, nice.
Which is a line from one
of
his
songs. So, Trev, why do you think why is his legend so enduring, do you think? I was listening to some last night, and it's funny that I noticed that all the songs, I listened to quite a few of his old records, and there are only three, really. And all the songs are about, the lyrics are about sun and time and birdsong and spring and leaves and fruit trees and stars. You know, and there's nothing at all specific that you can locate in even any century, really. There's something completely timeless about it.
Yeah.
There's no stories, there's no anecdotes, there's no drama, there's no characters. They're very, very vague. I think that's part of the appeal, don't you? They don't seem to date in any way. You don't kind of, you don't get tired of them. You can apply them to anything.
Yeah, I think that's completely right. And I think he would have liked that because he wanted to be Yeats, really, and Shelley. Yeah. And he wanted to be a great poet alongside being, you know, a great guitar player. And I think he would have liked that a lot. I think, you know, I was looking at the other, this is my favorite of his records is this one, which is the first one.
Well,
right.
Yeah.
My green screen's can't deal with that because it's great.
Right. That's great.
But Five Leaves Left is one of those records like Astral Weeks that picks you up and takes you somewhere. It's not a collection of songs. It's like a movie. And you feel as though he's created an atmosphere for you to live in for 40 minutes. Brighter Later doesn't quite achieve that for me, but I think that's one of the reasons that people love him, that he creates that world that you can go and submerge yourself in.
Completely. Saw him, did you? I mean, you would have. We were all too young.
No, I never saw him. My connection. He hardly ever played. My connection with him was simply that I bought the record one time and just loved it, and then I discovered that he had been to the same college as me in Cambridge.
Did you have the same room, or am I imagining that?
No, I did. I managed to get his old room while I was there.
That's right.
Yeah.
Incredible.
And I sat there for hours
with an acoustic guitar, waiting for the muse to be...
Ever happened.
That's great.
I'll tell you the thing that struck me. This is Brighter Later. And is the picture on the back here. I don't know if it's taken by Keith Morris. It probably is. Yeah, it took pretty much all these photographs, didn't he? And... it's a classic example of a photograph, the photographic cliche of the time for a singer-songwriter, which was, here he is. I don't know if he's standing on the West Way or something.
Yeah, it is. It's exactly the West Way.
It's on the West Way, which has probably only just been built at the time, I think. And he's watching cars going past. And there's another famous picture of Nick Drake where it was on the back of, is it on the back of Five Leave Left, where he's standing against a wall. There you go. And while
a
man rushes by. And if you look, photographs of the time, you find this cliche repeated again and again. It's the idea that I'm the man who stands still and reflects while the world races by on its tawdry daily business.
I'm above the irksome hurly burly.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Planet Earth.
You held up the back sleeve. Did you spot the spelling mistake?
Oh, good God!
There's a typo. It says in the middle of the central column. It says all bass and string arrangements by Robert Kirby, which should be all brass.
Oh, of
and
course,
string arrangements.
Oh, of course.
And this was an issue that dogged Nick Drake because his first album, which I won't hold up again because it's too green, except in the middle here of the original Five Leaves Left, they've printed the words to the song called 3 Hours, but they've called it Sundown. And then there's other mistakes on the back here where they've got the tracks in the wrong order. You know, the Island were not... as assiduous as they might have been.
Yeah, well, I think that applied to all record companies in those days. And also, they were turning these things around so quickly, weren't they? You know,
they were. Yeah. One thing that you said, which I ought to mention, is it is said that it came out in March 1971, right or later, but actually it was released in November 1970.
Well, did it actually get out?
It got out, it was released, it was advertised not very well, but then it was withdrawn very quickly from Ireland's promotional campaign because they realised it would get lost in the Christmas rush. Right. And then they revisited it after Christmas and decided, no, we'll put it out again and we can probably promote it in America, by which time Joe Boyd had gone off to America anyway.
Yeah.
And they, you know, he'd made a record, Joe, that he thought would break Nick Drake in America. And that was the story of it. So it got kind of half released and then released again.
Right. Yeah.
What do you think he'd be doing now? It's one of those things that you can never quite figure out. You know, there's whole events like Green Man Festival, which seem to be built almost around the aesthetic that he created. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And you kind of think, would he be, I don't know, would he be one of those characters who made some money out of advertising and film soundtrack and be living in the south of France somewhere in kind of semi-retirement? Or would he be making records with Badly Drawn Boy and Laura Marling? You've got absolutely no idea. I mean...
I think, if he'd stayed well, you know, if he'd got over his mental health issues, I think by now he'd probably be a Brexiteer Tory in the House of Lords, because he'd be very rich. His father sold his business later for gazillions, and he would have inherited all that. He was known, although the kind of legend has grown that he was, you know, misunderstood, slightly kind of schizophrenic, depressive kind of bloke, but was very cool. But actually, a lot of people didn't like him. They thought that he was lazy and a bit snooty and a bit sort of
aloof.
The world owes me a living. There was a bit of that about him. So
that's a kind of slightly middle class kind of Kevin Ayers thing, isn't it? You know, I have made these great records and now I expect the world to beat a path to my door.
Tell me
how fabulous they are. And he wouldn't go out and tour. Did he do all those tours supporting people like, I can't remember, Atomic Rooster or something? They were obviously disastrous, you know.
You'd got towards the end of his life, he'd got his parents saying, for God's sake, Nicky, put your bloody guitar down and get a job. You'd got his sister saying, I'm not having anything to do with you while you're taking all those drugs. You've got his managers buggered off to America. He hasn't really got any friends. He's having a very painful time of it.
So you can
see why, you know, it ended the way it did.
I'll tell you, it was really funny. I was thinking about him when, I don't know if you've heard that folk on foot thing that Matthew Bannister did with Richard Thompson.
Yeah.
And Richard Thompson and Nick Drake, probably born of the same year, you know, came up the same way, sensational guitar players when they were 17, 18 years old. And Richard Thompson doesn't seem like the world's most confident man when you meet him. Kind of stammers and shies away. But he does stuff. And he did that thing with Matthew. And he's standing out there in Wardour Street singing a song in his, you know, in his 70s to illustrate a point. And it really struck me just how bulletproof people have to be to get on. You know, the Richard Thompson's always had the confidence to go in the room, stand up and sing a song. Nick Drake never had that confidence, did he?
No, he never did.
Also, it's all about projection, isn't it? It's about seeing and thinking, my job now is to captivate everybody in the room.
It's to
nail their attention and have them look at me. And not that I ever saw him, obviously, but I mean, you can't imagine Nick Drake was the kind of personality he could have done that or believed he should have done.
Here's one of the things about Nick Drake that explains his problem, I think, with live performance. Every single song has a different tuning on the guitar. Now, the way you get around that in modern days is you have 15 guitars behind you, all tuned by some roadie, and you've also got all these electrical digital things to help you. In those days, you had to sit there and go, and actually tune your guitar up. And because he had no banter, you know, he wasn't Billy Connolly, he couldn't do all that stuff. So he was he was very boring, and he took a lot of time in between his songs to get the tuning right. And
it's death, isn't it?
That terrible. Kind
of it's really interesting. Well, I've seen Richard Thompson do shows, acoustic shows, where he retunes all the time, and he just has a bit of banter, and he has the confidence to cover that period, so that your attention doesn't drop away. Whereas if somebody just sits there and just does that, they've lost you, haven't they?
But also, Nick Drake, I read a review of him recently where he said that he went on stage supporting somebody or other, and actually the first thing he did for 2.5 minutes was tune his guitar. So he hadn't even tuned the guitar right for that first song, which is absolutely unbelievable. It's really, really, it's arrogance, isn't it, really? Yeah. It's appalling.
And he was, I mean, the tunings are bizarre. You know, it's worth having a wander around YouTube and looking at the tutorials about how to play like Nick Drake. Very few of them get anywhere near it, because the tunings are really odd, and he wouldn't use a capo. And that's why on Brighter Later, the first song after the first instrumental, which is called Hazy Jane 2, is in the wrong key. You know, he can't quite sing it. It should have been, if you were the producer, you'd say, can you drop that a tone, please, Nick?
Yeah.
But he couldn't do that. He could play these chord shapes anywhere else on the guitar. So that was the key it was in, because that's what fitted his finger patterns.
Talking to this business with strings, I was sending Mark and Alex a clip this week of a violinist. What was she? I can't remember what she was playing with the full orchestra on stage somewhere in Europe, where one of her strings went just near the absolute climax of this thing. And she just turned, and I don't know if this is standard operating procedure in orchestras, she just swapped violins with the first violinist and went straight into it.
Absolutely. Just literally grabbed it off him, really. Oi, hang on.
No, but he must be a thing that happens, mustn't it?
That's brilliant.
Because she didn't look around as if she didn't know what to do. She did know what to do. This is what you do. If this nightmare happens once in your performing career, because it probably will. I thought it was extraordinary. Yeah. And you had that clip of Stevie Ray Vaughan, didn't you, Mark?
Well, that's wonderful. I didn't ever see that, Trevor. It's brilliant. It's on YouTube. It's Stevie Ray Vaughan playing. And he's obviously got a thing where if he breaks a string, obviously he's got a roadie behind him with a new guitar. He just looks at this guy and while singing the chorus, takes off his guitar, straps the new one on, it's plugged in, and within, 5 seconds, he's already playing again. He's like, this is brilliant, you know.
Yeah.
I love things like that. It's so pro, you know. I love it.
I do. I love it.
Which is about as far from Nick Drake as you could possibly get, actually.
The great thing about the Stevie Ray clip was he just soloed around it.
Yeah,
absolutely astonishing. I'm going to continue my solo. I'm just not going to use that area of the guitar.
Exactly. Fantastic.
Oh, very fantastic. Good. Trevor, it's been lovely to see you.
And you. Thank you for having me, Mark and David.
A real joy. Lovely.
You and your green screen and all. And we shall look forward to catching up with you with the green screen of a pub in the background, possibly.
I think when we've finished living La Vida lockdown, we shall... Meet again.
Excellent.
Trevor, all the best. Thank you very much.
See you.
Bye.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
Yeah. There is disaster at every stage in this book.
Really, I've got it. It's incredible.
I'm just going out by page 261, which is always my favorite thing when the kind of out of it rock star's wife is about to produce another child. It's how the out of it rock star deals with it, you know. They got a phone call from Pam. The baby's coming. We jump in the car, get over to Beehive, which is where Steve Marriott was living at the time. Get them a car and on the way to the hospital. Steve says, hang on a minute, I've got to get some tobacco. Steve gets out. Pam's in the car. Steve's taking his time. What's he doing? I think he's having a conversation with a bloke in the shop. He comes out. Oh, I'm just talking to the bloke a minute. Won't be long. Steve, Pam's having a baby. She'll be all right. I was just telling him something. That's the kind of stuff that you find pretty much on every page of this. All or nothing.
The description of the beehive, the house. Oh my God, eventually they finish up recording there because it's the only way they can get into records. It's a bit like, you know, Rolling Stones in the south of France. Let's do it at Keith's house.
Yeah, absolutely. Bee, you know.
And it's just terrible. And there's the chickens and the ducks are all wandering in, you know, crapping all over the kitchen. It just, the whole thing seems so frightful, you know.
All or nothing, the authorized, amazingly, this is the authorized story of
time. I know. You can't believe the damning information that's been let through, don't you think?
Absolutely. It's eye-watering, it really is. By Simon Spence, and it's out now. And here, Simon's joining us for a crowdcast conversation.
On Wednesday night.
On Wednesday. Really, so if you're a Patreon supporter, you can be in the room, as we like to say, when we do that. We record it later on, goes out on YouTube. And so if you want to know about how you might get involved as a Patreon supporter, patreon.com/wordinyourear, and you can find out all the various different ways that you can get involved. And don't forget, it's the only way that you can get to see and hear everything that we do, and get to see and hear it first. And also get the warm glow of feeling that you've helped contribute to keeping the bright red ball of human interest in the air while this
keep
bloody war drags on.
Inflated. Yeah, exactly.
So have we got anything we want to add? We got any new Patreons?
We've got some new Patreons?
We do, yes. And they are.
I've got a whistle.
No, you've got... Sorry. Al Campion.
Al Campion,
good
consider
man.
Yourself
aboard,
piped
Al.
Aboard, Al.
Kevin Conway.
Kevin Conway. That's also him. You, Kevin. Make space for Kevin Conway.
Chuck Smeaton.
Chucks.
What a splendid name. Chuck Smeaton.
Chuck Smeaton. Oh, right.
Very pleased to have him at the party.
Very good.
Rob Cumberland.
Rob Cumberland. Hello, Rob.
Rob, come on in, have a light ale and enjoy some of these peanuts. Very nice to see you.
And last but certainly not least, Ashley Nicholas Spicer.
All right, move up for Ashley. And there's lots of room for more of you. So patreon.com/wordinyourear. We'll be back with you soon.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.